No Deal Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. This afternoon at the White House,
I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
He is putting the United States on a path to war with Iran. If we 6 months from now, 9 months from now, 12 months from now, are on the brink of war with Iran, it should be clear to all that that war was started today by Donald Trump and no one else but him.
What the president has done is he's placed the U.S. in violation of its commitment to the Iran deal. And in doing so, he's undermining negotiations with North Korea before they even begin.
The U.S. bails on the Iran deal, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. After weeks of anticipation, months really, President Trump has finally unveiled his decision on the Iran nuclear deal.
Today, I want to update the world on our efforts to prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon.
Trump was widely expected to pull the U.S. out of a deal he's famously called the worst ever, and that's exactly what he did, making the announcement from the diplomatic room at the White House.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen. In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
Trump also said he would reinstate full U.S. economic sanctions on Iran. The president of Iran also made a statement today, right after Trump spoke at the White House. Hassan Rouhani went on Iranian state TV to blast the U.S. for not fulfilling its side of the nuclear pact. And he said Iran would start enriching uranium again if the deal collapses. But he also said today that the Iranian government would continue to talk with the other parties still committed to the agreement.
The foundation of our policy is to work and have constructive relations with the world. Whether or not we are under sanctions, we should move towards standing on our own feet.
The World's News editor Chris Wolfe joins me now. Chris, what happened today?
What we witnessed this afternoon, Marco, was the United States unilaterally withdrawing from a negotiated diplomatic agreement without any clear or apparent explanation as to why. It's something that's baffled our allies, many of our allies, and has confused our partners. And I've spoken to several international security experts, and they're all asking the same questions. Why do this? Why break something that is working?
So what does it all mean, especially without the Trump White House having a plan B?
Well, effectively, the deal will die without the United States. The European allies, led by France, have expressed their regrets at what the president has said already. They're keen to try and keep the deal alive. They've said they want to continue it. Iran's President Rouhani has said something very similar, that they'd like to continue the deal. But John Bolton, the national security advisor, has said in the last hour is that the sanctions that were in effect at the time of the deal coming into place are now back in effect. And that's going to have a critical effect on European companies' decisions to invest and do trade with Iran, because what could happen to them is they'd be sanctioned by the United States by using the international banking system. There was a huge process, 5 years of work, to come up with this international sanctions program that effectively persuaded and cajoled and bullied the rest of the world into enforcing the sanctions against Iran. That's what brought Iran to the negotiating table. And they're going to try and bring that system back. It's a very effective system. But the problem now is that there's a good chance the Europeans and the Chinese may try to resist that sanctions regime. There's no enthusiasm to support it. So it's not clear how the U.S. is going to impose its will on the world, or even what that will is.
And realistically, is it fair to think of the JCPOA, this Iran deal, working without the U.S. in it? Can they just continue and do it?
They can try. But as I said, the sanctions regime is structured so that the U.S. is going to be able to put pressure on its European and other allies so that they're going to end up harming Iran. Iran benefits from this deal by the economic liberalization of trade and the relaxation of sanctions, allowing renewed investment in Iran to some extent. And the benefits have been not as great as they expected, but they are nevertheless real. And the fear is that now they're going to lose that. So it's a good chance that anything could happen.
With the U.S. backing out of this deal, how free is Iran to pursue a nuclear weapon at this point, and how long would it take before they get a nuke?
Well, really, yes, that step is up to Iran. They could well start the race for a nuke. They could have the analysis that what's the point in trying to deal with the U.S.? Look at North Korea. They took the step to the nuclear threshold, and now they have an effective deterrent, and that's bringing the U.S. to the negotiating table. On the other hand, if Iran does go for a nuclear program, that really does raise the specter of war in the region as well. Israel is unlikely to stand by and watch that happen. And if Iran is rushing towards the nuclear weapon, the European allies may well come back reluctantly into the fold as well.
I come back to that and say the Iran deal, the JCPOA, has a very strict inspection regime. And now I suspect Iran is not likely to let inspectors in. So how would the world even know if they're making...
Yeah, it's an important point to make, Marco. The deal is working. Iran is in full compliance with the JCPOA. This has been, you don't take my word for it, look at the IAEA's latest statement. The State Department itself reconfirmed Iran's compliance just a couple of weeks ago. The U.S. is taking this action willfully to withdraw and violate this international agreement without any real justification being put forward. Trump has said Iran is behaving badly around the world in the region, but it's not supposed to. That's not part of the deal. That was deliberately excluded to try and focus on the one point, to try and avoid a nuclear war in the Middle East.
So, Chris, what comes next?
Well, there's a lot of people are drawing all kinds of analogies to 2002, with people like John Bolton, the National Security Advisor.
And the ramp-up to the war in Iraq.
Coming into an office, exactly. And people may be interested to hear what John Bolton had to say about Iran just last year, speaking to a group of Iranian exiles.
The behavior and the objectives of the regime are not going to change, and therefore the only solution is to change the regime itself. And that's why before 2019, we here will celebrate in Tehran. Thank you very much.
So it does feel very much like that moment in 2002 when the U.S. claimed Iraq had WMD.
Well, a lot of national security experts are tweeting to that effect, that they're having flashbacks. I wouldn't say that yet. I mean, it seems that that's, as one expert told me, that's war is not Trump's intent. His hope is to try and get a better deal, but it's not clear how he can. Now he's broken Iran's trust in the United States.
The World's Chris Wolf, thanks very much for explaining this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's not forget that the decisions made in Washington, D.C. impact the lives of millions of people.
The World's Shirin Jafari joins me in the studio now.
Hey, Marco.
Shirin, you've been monitoring how Iranians are seeing today's decision by President Trump and how it may impact them. What have you been hearing?
Well, of course, a lot of people are worried about what kind of impact this announcement is going to have on their day-to-day lives. When the deal was initially announced 3 years ago, a lot of Iranians thought this issue is resolved. They thought they could do business with the outside world, join the international community. When the sanctions were lifted, they were expecting more jobs, more foreign investment in Iran, and in general, a better life. All that is now in question. Also, when the deal was announced, there was a sense of relief in Iran because for a long time, there had been talk of war and confrontation with Iran. And so Iranians felt that war was not likely to happen. This is something that Sam Sinai mentioned to me today when I talked to him. He's an Iranian student working on his PhD at Harvard University. He said, I was born during the Iran-Iraq war back in the 1980s. He said, I grew up with the fear of war in the back of my mind, and this carried on for years.
I grew up in my teenage years always worrying about an attack on Iran and an attack on my home. So that had a very traumatic experience, and I kept having recurrent nightmares about this up to the point the nuclear deal was signed. And then for the past 3 years, I was hoping that the two countries would go on a path of conflict resolution through diplomacy. And the new administration completely threw that out in the wind. And it's yet another missed opportunity to come to a better state of affairs.
I can totally relate to that, Marco. I was born around the same time, and it really was a traumatic experience for the whole country. And it's something that most Iranians don't want to relive.
Right. So obviously one big consequence of Trump pulling out of the deal is that Iranians may feel less secure now. But how else things could change for Iran?
Iranians have been through this before, right? Before there was a nuclear deal, Iran faced severe sanctions from the U.S. and Europeans. That meant they were not able to access the global market, the global banking system. International companies could not operate inside Iran. And Iran, for example, couldn't get spare parts for its planes. And there were a whole host of other restrictions. Some of these were eased after the deal came through. Now people are worried that things are going to return to that situation. Trump could revive the sanctions that were in place before the deal, and that could mean a lot of economic hardship for average Iranians.
So I read that even before this announcement today by Trump, there were already tensions in the markets in Iran.
That's right. I started noticing changes in the exchange rate of U.S. dollar in Iran about a month ago. Today, the Iranian currency, the rial, is at its lowest point it has ever been. And typically, when the price of U.S. dollar goes up, the price of everything else goes up. Price of gas, for example, eggs, bread, all of that. So today's decision is just going to add to the instability in the market.
Shirin, what have Iranian officials been saying about Trump's decision?
They've been downplaying it, saying that they have full control of the market and they feel very confident. They've even hinted at switching the official transactions from U.S. dollar to euro. But that's probably more symbolic than a policy change. But don't forget that President Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran deal plays right into the hands of the Iranian hardliners.
How so?
They have been arguing since the moment the agreement was signed that this is a bad deal for Iran. Now they say, look, this just shows that U.S. cannot be trusted and that there's no point in negotiating with the Americans.
It sounds like there is so much potential for fallout from Trump's decision today.
Right. And Sam Sinai, the student I talked to today, said that as an Iranian immigrant living in the U.S., he feels like the Trump administration's latest position on Iran adds yet more anxiety to his life here.
It's not just about this withdrawing from the deal. The country's policies are very opposite of what I would consider welcoming to immigrants. For instance, my Iranian German aunt was hoping to visit US for a wedding in her family recently, and they were told, even if we give you a visa, there's no guarantee that we will not return you at the border in the airport.
Now, we don't know the exact details of his aunt's situation and her application, but what we do know is that this administration has been more stringent when it comes to issuing visas for people from several Muslim-majority countries, including Iran.
Well, obviously, we'll be staying on this story and Trump's decision for a while. The World's Shirin Jafari, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
We'll have more coverage of the Iran nuclear deal and President Trump's decision today later in the show. I'll be speaking with Suzanne DiMaggio, who helped negotiate with the Iranians. She's already worried about how the North Koreans will receive Trump's message.
He's about to launch what I would call the most consequential diplomatic effort of his presidency over North Korea's nuclear program. He should be pointing to the Iran deal and its most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated as a model for any future agreement with the North Koreans. And instead, he has dealt a significant blow to nuclear verification.
That's coming up in a bit. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here's something I learned today. Government soldiers in Myanmar's Rakhine State are anxious about cell phones. They're worried that the region's Rohingya minority are using their phones to document the atrocities committed by the country's armed forces. And it turns out many Rohingya citizen activists are risking their lives to make cell phone videos of violence as it's happening in their villages. A new PBS Frontline documentary premiering tonight uses these citizen videos to tell the story of the Rohingya. The film is called Myanmar's Killing Fields, and a warning, the doc and our discussion about it contain graphic descriptions of violence. Evan Williams is the producer and reporter. He told me about a Rohingya man called Sabo, who was part of a network of activists who took immense risks to provide him with cell phone videos.
They were there filming as people were basically turning up dead, large numbers of Rohingya turning up dead after military assaults on their villages. They gave me hundreds of their videos under very strict confidentiality rules and screening for them.
So I'd like us to hear Sabo explaining to you why he made these videos. So he says, we're not getting justice, even though it was risky. I did it for my people. So, Evan, what would have happened to Sabo if he'd been caught videoing these atrocities?
He would have been possibly beaten, tortured, and, in his own words, possibly executed.
Now, one of the chilling stories Sabo helps you tell is about what happened in a place called Chut Pien in August of last year. Apparently, Myanmar's military killed an estimated 358 villagers there, a third of them kids. What happened? What did Sabo tell you?
Just happened that he was in a nearby village and many dozens of civilians were arriving there. Many of them shot in the back and in the back of the legs as they fled the soldiers attacking their village. The army, of course, insists that they were targeting militants who were attacking them, but the video evidence demonstrates that that's not true. And then ladies told us, women, older women told us that they'd been separated from the young women and that soldiers ripped the young babies out of their arms. Any women who complained or screamed were shot on the site. And I'm told that 10 women were killed in that way. And then they threw the babies and children into a burning house alive. I've got to say, I've been doing this for a while and I've never come across anything quite like this. And one woman told us in particular, Rashida, that as the children tried to get out of the flames, they were pushed back in with bamboo sticks by the soldiers. So this extraordinary savagery, this brutality, can only be explained, I think, as an act aimed at terrifying the Rohingya to make them leave Myanmar.
Yeah, it leaves you speechless. There was a similar massacre happened in a village called Tula Toil, where more than 1,000 people were killed. And here you had a child named Razia. She's got machete scars on her head. She helps tell the story. Here she's describing the burning of her village. Evan, what is that girl describing?
She's talking there about the fact that she was taken with her mother by two soldiers. She'd seen her own brother and father killed, shot by soldiers. Then she was taken with her mother to a house. She was there as her mother was raped by a soldier while the other guy held her down. As she was being raped, of course, the young girl was screaming. And the soldiers macheted her or slashed her on the head three times with a machete. The wounds are still on her head. And then they locked the door, poured petrol on the front of the house and set the house on fire. And they weren't the only people in there. There were other women. And her mother was basically unconscious in front of her in this extraordinary scene. And she pushes her mother and wakes her up and says, Mum, the house is on fire. You're burning. Mm. And they found a small opening in the back, crawled towards it, got out of the house, and as the soldiers were busy elsewhere, crawled towards some bushes and managed to escape.
Burma's best-known leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, would not speak with you. You reached out to Myanmar's military and only got a low-level spokesperson. How did he justify the military's action?
I was very, very enthusiastic about hearing from the government and from Aung San Suu Kyi, but they did not want to engage. The minister himself is the minister for repatriation. He said, well, nobody killed civilians and nobody burnt anything. And, you know, it's all sort of made up as the general inference from what he said there. And then we discovered later that actually state media had shown him in the Rakhine area with the military 2 days after the major assault began.
Here is State Councillor Aung San Suu Kyi recently defending the country's military. This is from your doc as well.
The security forces have been instructed to exercise all due restraint and to take full measures to avoid collateral damage and the harming of innocent civilians.
So, Evan, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Bill Richardson, is also in your doc, and he's an old friend of Aung San Suu Kyi. And he sat down with her in January and tried to convince her to let the U.N. into Myanmar. Here's Bill Richardson describing her response.
I said, look, my own government, the Secretary of State, says it's ethnic cleansing. And she exploded. She said, Bill, you've got an agenda. There's terrorism with some of the Rohingyas. That's when we had a huge altercation. I thought if we were closer, she would hit me. I could see the anger in her face. It was obvious she saw the Rohingyas as not part of Myanmar. That's when I realized she had changed. She had gone from a human rights heroine, a beacon of democracy, to a politician wanting to cater to the military, wanting the military to support her. She wants to get reelected.
Evan Williams, that part of Richardson's clip where he says it was obvious Aung San Suu Kyi saw the Rohingyas as not a part of Myanmar, I thought that was really telling because you've also got the head of the military in your doc refusing to accept that there's even a minority in the country known as Rohingya, that they're all descendants of undesirable Bangladeshis. So is he the one who has essentially set the policy that Aung San Suu Kyi follows, that the rest of the country follows? And if so, doesn't that tell us that Myanmar is way off this path to democracy that they're supposed to be on?
You've well identified that, Marco. It's absolutely the core issue here. The Commander-in-Chief, General Minon Laing, has said publicly that there is no Rohingya race in Myanmar and that he's conducting unfinished business against Bengali immigrants. Aung San Suu Kyi has picked up the similar narrative, it seems, and will not even use the word Rohingya, neither will any government official, because it is politically unpopular in predominantly Buddhist Burma, and both the army and Aung San Suu Kyi are looking at the next election. They don't want to lose votes, and that's why I believe this violence has been perpetuated in the way it has.
Myanmar's Killing Fields premieres on PBS Frontline tonight. Evan Williams, who produced and reported the documentary, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Marco. Really appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll hear from Basir Kazi. He's a doctor at Advocate Lutheran General Hospital in Park Ridge, Illinois. And back in March, he made a 10-day trip to Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh. The experience, he says, was profound.
For me personally, the most catastrophic experience was, you know, seeing these little kids, 9 years old, 6 years old, 5 years old, walking into the clinic, no shoes, poor hygiene, poor dental hygiene. I wouldn't say they're completely malnourished, but, you know, they're undernourished at least. And just seeing that picture day in and day out, that was the most difficult thing, especially having young kids. And you just figure that could have been my kid right there. That was the most difficult part of my trip.
My conversation with Dr. Basir Kazi, that's tomorrow here on the show. I'm Marco Werman. After Hurricane Maria, a college in Maine offered Puerto Rican students help. Now some of them are hoping to help others back home.
Not many students in Puerto Rico will have this opportunity. And if I can maybe be a teacher and I can give to them what I've learned from all these experiences, well, that's what I would like.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump today made it official. The U.S. is pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. Trump announced his decision after months of publicly denouncing the agreement. So keep that in mind for the next few minutes as we focus on an alleged behind-the-scenes effort to undermine the deal. Over the weekend, the Observer newspaper in Britain reported that Trump aides had hired an Israeli private security company called Black Cube to dig up dirt on the creators and supporters of the Iran deal. The operation's existence has since been corroborated by the New Yorker magazine. Among those targeted by Black Cube were former Vice President Joe Biden, as well as President Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes. Also, Trita Parsi. He's president of the National Iranian American Council, and he advised the Obama White House in the lead-up to the agreement. First of all, Trita, what is your reaction to Trump's decision to pull out of the Iran nuclear deal?
What he is doing is creating a crisis out of what was a diplomatic triumph, and he is putting the United States on a path to war with Iran. If we 6 months from now, 9 months from now, 12 months from now are on the brink of war with Iran, it should be clear to all that that war was started today by Donald Trump and no one else but him.
So you're known as a strong supporter of the deal, and you say that during the presidential transition last year, you received a warning from U.S. intelligence officials. Tell us about that.
Well, it came through an intermediary. It was a message to me that I should watch out because they had information that the Trump administration or the people there were going to go after me and others who had been helpful towards getting this nuclear deal. And their effort would be to discredit and silence us.
So a kind of dirty tricks campaign.
They didn't tell me exactly what was going to be happening. They just said that I'm going to be a target.
And then last summer, you received a call that you now believe was made by people working for this Israeli private intelligence firm, Black Cube.
Well, we know now that it was. I mean, at the time, I didn't think much of it. It was just, I do plenty of interviews, and this was just another interview. It's not until this past weekend when Ronan Farrow called me and read to me a transcript of that conversation that I realized that this was something a bit more dirty.
So Ronan Farrow called you on behalf of the reporting that he was doing for The New Yorker.
Yeah, exactly.
So that phone call last summer, whoever made the call, how did they present themselves to you and what kind of questions did they ask you during that call?
As I recall, I received an email over my website and someone who requested an interview. And there wasn't anything particularly eye-catching or strange about that email or about the conversation, at least in the beginning, with this person, because it was just the same regular questions that I had answered 100 times before. It's not until towards the end when he's kind of pushing this idea that the Obama administration was doing this deal because of some sort of a financial interest that it got a little bit weird. And it turned out that it was Black Cube, that was this Israeli intelligence firm that was essentially trying to dig up dirt and trap people to be able to say things that would be incriminating against some of the people in the Obama administration and others who had helped get this deal.
Why do you think you specifically were targeted? And as far as you're aware, was this the only attempt to get information from you?
I'm not aware if there has been other attempts, but it wouldn't be surprising to me. The reason I think I was targeted is partly, of course, because they were trying to find something incriminating against members of the Obama administration. But my organization and I myself have been a target for quite some time because we have been a voice for the Iranian-American community pushing back against war. We believe that this problem between the U.S. and Iran can be resolved peacefully. This, of course, is taking it to a completely different level.
So the State Department has recently confirmed that Iran is in compliance with the deal. And given what we believe was this White House scheme to create false narratives, what should that tell us about the motivation of Trump today pulling out of the deal?
I think that's an excellent question because we have actually a fully functioning deal. The only problem with this deal is that Donald Trump is cheating. The Iranians have actually lived up to their end of the bargain. The U.S. State Department says this. The U.S. intelligence says this. I think from Trump's perspective, this is part of his broader agenda of trying to undo everything that has Barack Obama's name on it, regardless of what disastrous geopolitical consequences it will have in the region and what disastrous consequences it will have for U.S. national security.
And just to clarify, when you said you see this as Trump cheating, I mean, he's the president. He can do whatever he wants, right? He can pull out of this deal if he wants. Why is that cheating?
Well, I mean, he has an obligation to live up to this deal. The United States signature should have some value. And it is more than just what Donald Trump wishes to do or not to do. The United States is a serious country with obligations, and he has to take those obligations seriously.
Trita Parsi there. He's president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. As President Trump announced his decision to bail on the nuclear deal with Iran today, he also revealed that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on his way to a different country to discuss the possibility of a different nuclear deal.
Secretary Pompeo is right now going to North Korea. He will be there very shortly in a matter of probably an hour.
Trump said preparations are underway for his meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
And we look forward to have a very great success. We think relationships are building with North Korea. We'll see how it all works out. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. But it can be a great thing for North Korea, South Korea, Japan, and the entire world. We hope it all works out. Thank you very much.
President Trump sounding hopeful there about his ability to reach an agreement with North Korea. But Suzanne DiMaggio of the New America Foundation, someone who's actually sat down for talks with the North Koreans, she thinks Trump's decision on Iran today will make that deal more difficult.
He's about to launch what I would call the most consequential diplomatic effort of his presidency over North Korea's nuclear program. He should be pointing to the Iran deal and its most intrusive inspections regime ever negotiated as a model for any future agreement with the North Koreans. And instead, he has dealt a significant blow to nuclear verification.
I mean, Trump thinks that there are too many holes in the Iran deal. Doesn't that mean that the deal with North Korea is going to take even more delicate negotiation?
Well, of course. I mean, let's not forget that the Iranians never actually had a nuclear weapons program. They had plans for one, but they never actually built it. With North Korea, we have a regime that has an estimated 20 nuclear bombs already in its possession, and ICBMs that could hit any city in the United States. So the negotiations with North Korea are going to be a lot more extensive by their nature. And the fact that Trump is so ready to blow this deal apart with the Iranians without having a plan B in place is very reckless.
I mean, if North Korea already has a nuclear deterrent, why on earth would they bother signing a nuclear agreement with Trump if, another U.S. administration could come in later and just kill the deal?
Well, I think the North Koreans are seriously considering rolling back their program in exchange for economic sanctions. They do want to get their economy up and running. So that's their incentive. But if they see a U.S. administration that can't even abide by a deal with Iran, why on earth would they think the U.S. would abide by a deal with them?
News reports suggest that the Trump administration wants to even broaden the agenda for this expected summit with Kim Jong-un. What is your sense? What exactly do you think Trump and Kim have to talk about?
Well, I think the nuclear program obviously is going to be at the top of the agenda for Trump, as well as it well should be. But I think the denuclearization process is not just dismantlement of the program. There are going to have to be steps to get there. That's going to have to be the end goal. Right now, they have a nuclear and missile test suspension in place. The next phase probably would be freezing any advancement of the program. And that's going to have to include getting inspectors on the ground in North Korea to verify it. And with the Iran deal, that's exactly what we got. That was the innovation of the deal, that process was so extensive. And in that sense, it should have been held up as a model.
Are there any signs that encourage you that a deal with North Korea is more possible between Trump and Kim than anything that we might expect out of Iran and the United States right now?
I think right now, of course, the mood with North Korea is a lot more positive. And also, the North Koreans, most importantly, have said that they're ready to discuss denuclearization. So they have indicated an openness to this process going forward. What Trump has just done with the Iran deal is not going to, by any means, put the Iranians in any mood to re-engage on a deal that has been working for them and for the world by and large. They've already done a lot of things to get to this point. They've gone through a lot of hoops. They've fulfilled commitments. And for them to have a deal that Trump is reneging on, and let's face it, it seems like he's reneging on this deal, not because of real flaws, but more because it was something President Obama negotiated. It was his key foreign policy legacy, and Trump has always made it clear that he would not let it continue.
Suzanne DiMaggio of the New America Foundation, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's hit pause on the Iran deal for a moment and talk about, let's talk about ourselves. As you know, the BBC World Service is one of the partners that helped produce this program. The BBC prides itself on its independent journalism and in being just as ready to criticize the British government as anyone else. But here's another side to the relationship between the BBC and the British government. For years, there was a secret system in place which allowed British intelligence to vet BBC job applicants. It was meant to identify potentially subversive employees, and that system continued right up until the 1990s. My colleague Paul Reynolds, himself a veteran BBC reporter, has been looking into the vetting files.
Marco, it goes right back to 1933 when people worried about communists and to a lesser extent fascists getting into the BBC. In fact, there's one quote in the files which said that some evilly disposed engineer might throw the whole network. Anyway, a system was set up to vet every single applicant into the BBC. This was slimmed down over the years, but basically they were looking for members of the Communist Party and later on for neo-fascist parties as well.
So everybody who applied was sent through this process?
Well, it wasn't everybody who applied. What happened was that if you applied for a job, particularly in the news division, if you were successful in that application, that success depended on you going through what's called the formalities system, which is a check with the British Internal Intelligence Service called MI5, or the Security Service. Now, you weren't told about this. Your name went to them. If nothing was found against you, your application was successful and nobody knew anything about it, including yourself. But if something was known about you, mysteriously, you would find that you weren't selected for the job.
And what kinds of things would have prevented a person from getting hired once they went through that process?
Well, we know, I spoke to one guy called Tom Archer who said he had been an active socialist at university. Normally the BBC overlooked that as a youthful enthusiasm, but it turned out that a close relative of his, joined a very left-wing group called the Socialist Workers' Party, and he was excluded on those grounds. Later on, the irony is that he came back in triumph to the BBC and was head of factual documentaries, which was a very pleasurable moment for him, he told me.
Wow, I'm sure. There was, in these documents, that there was this elaborate system for marking up job applications, including something called Christmas trees. What were those about?
If you were suspected of something by, in the report back from the Security Service, they drew a Christmas tree, or it was a little red triangle with a tail on it, really, on your normal file. And that alerted the BBC to the fact that there was a security issue about you, so that if you were promoted or something, they would have to check back. So this was known as the Christmas tree system. And in fact, on the day the system was revealed by the Observer in 1985, somebody went and hung some Christmas tree decorations on the door of room 105, where this was all organized from.
Yes, some of our colleagues in our newsroom, including myself and our editor, joined the BBC in the early 90s. But I did get a job. So does that mean I passed the vetting or the vetting had ended?
I think probably by 1992 it would have ended. I think all security vetting actually ended in 1985 after this Observer story. There was some residual vetting for people who were going to take part in the secret bunker system for broadcasting during a nuclear war, or as the documents put it, a nuclear exchange. but that even that was stood down in 1992 after the end of the Cold War. So I frankly think you probably weren't vetted, but the vetting was pretty, you know, limited to people who had very close connections to these so-called subversive organizations.
Today, how does the BBC view employees or reporters with extreme political opinions?
Well, they refuse to comment on what they call security issues, but I have no reason to believe there's any vetting. Anyway, if there was, one of the things they brought in after the Observer story was that people should be told about it if they were being vetted. So to all intents and purposes, the system is finished.
My colleague at the BBC, Paul Reynolds, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Last summer, The World's Carolyn Beeler reported on the impending closure of one of the country's largest coal-fired power plants, the Navajo Generating Station, located near the Arizona-Utah border.
The power plant has been running since 1974 and supplies electricity to more than a million customers. But now, the operators want out.
There's cheaper energy options out there.
Paul Ostapuk is a manager at the Navajo Generating Station.
The primary driver is just the low cost of natural gas right now. It's making operation of this plant uneconomical.
After the facility announced it was closing, the president of the Navajo Nation called on President Trump to make good on his campaign promise to end the war on coal by bailing out the power plant.
I merely challenged President Trump, saying, we're the local people that you say you're going to listen to and that you're going to support the coal industry. Now is the time to make that real.
The case was seen as a test of President Trump's commitment to coal, but his administration hasn't taken any action yet, and now the issue's resurfacing. Carolyn Beeler joins me in the studio for an update. Remind us of where we left the story last summer, Carolyn.
So last June, the Navajo Generating Station reached an agreement to stay open until 2019 out of the hopes that a new buyer would emerge. But at the time, it was seen as a long shot. Coal-fired power plants are closing all around the country because they're just not the cheapest energy option anymore. But 2 weeks ago, it came out that there are two prospective buyers for this plant, and that is getting a lot of attention among people who watch the energy industry.
So why is this one plant seen as such a big deal?
Well, royalties from the plant provide a huge chunk of the operating budget for both the Navajo Nation and the Hopi tribe. But nationally, energy investors see the Navajo Generating Station as a kind of crystal ball, and they're looking for a signal of how coal is going to fare in the future. Energy analyst David Schlissel says there are two key questions.
Financial viability, whether they can make a profit. And what kind of subsidies will the federal and state governments give them?
Schlissel estimates that the plant would need at least $1 billion of subsidies to keep operating. So the question is really whether political will outweigh the economics of coal in this pretty high profile case.
I understand there are some people suing to keep the plant's main buyer from switching to another energy provider. Do you have any sense of whether any of that's going to work to keep the plant open?
It's hard to tell at this point. It's hard to tell if the buyers who are saying they're interested in buying actually are serious or if they just want to look at this plant's books. There have been some talks in Washington about the future of the plant, but nothing concrete has been proposed to save it. Today, I called a worker at the Navajo Generating Station who I met while I was out there last summer, Jerry Williams, and he is beginning to lose hope that he'll have a job past next year.
I like it to stay open, but somebody really needs to step up and say, we're here, we're going to take over. If I heard that, then I'd be convinced.
So he's really trying to roll with the punches amid all of this uncertainty, like really the whole region is.
Carolyn Beeler, the World's Livable Planet reporter, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Let's check in now on another story that we've been following since the fall, when Puerto Rico was hit by back-to-back hurricanes in September. Everything was disrupted. Power, food distribution, the ability of students to get an education. About 10,000 students in Puerto Rico ultimately came to the U.S. mainland to complete the year. That includes two students now at Bowdoin College in Maine. They're wrapping up their spring semester now and thinking about what comes next. They spoke with reporter Lisa Bartfai.
My name is Leonardo Nunez. When the hurricane came, the university was closed for about 40 days, I think it was.
And even when his university reopened, things weren't normal.
And when they started, you know, the Wi-Fi connection was really bad. There were almost no traffic lights, so the traffics were horrible. My apartment did not have electrical power sometimes, so it was really hard. You know, to study in that environment, it's not easy. You know, to study, you need to have, you know, the basic things of life at least, you know, settled.
So Leonardo, who is 19, started looking for schools on the mainland that were accepting transfer students from Puerto Rico. He found Bowdoin through an ad on Facebook. The offer covered tuition, housing, meals, travel, and books for one semester.
I'm Veronica Gutierrez Camacho, and I'm 21 years old.
Veronica heard about Bowdoin's offer through a friend.
My sister was really happy for me, but also sad that I wouldn't be around to, like, help her with her assignments and stuff.
Veronica and Leonardo arrived in Maine in January during record low temperatures, but the campus felt warm.
Yeah, what surprised me the most was just how welcoming and friendly everybody is. I don't know, I felt, like, included everywhere.
For Leonardo, it was the support that you get living on campus.
Every single thing, you don't have to cook, you don't have to wash your dishes, you don't have to worry about, you know, the things you normally have to when you're back home. So here you can just concentrate fully on your studies.
Veronica got a job, though, so she could send money back home. She got paid to film the lacrosse team practices and home games.
I didn't know anything about the sport. It's very exciting, but yeah, back home, there's no lacrosse.
But now that their guest term at Bowdoin is just about over, Leonardo and Veronica have to make decisions about their future. Leonardo feels the pull of home.
You know, there's so many roots you have back home, you know, your church, your friends, your people, your language. Even if you know English, if you're bilingual, if you feel you're ready, if you have the determination, it's not the same thing.
Veronica also misses family and friends, but 8 months after the hurricane, some of the instability that made her leave hasn't been resolved, and some of it predated Maria.
My university, Universidad de Puerto Rico, they have a history of having strikes. Even now, there's still talks of like having another strike because still the fiscal board that is overseeing the island is planning on raising the tuition and also decreasing the budget. So it's just a lot of interruptions that makes it hard to stay on track of my studies.
For now, Veronica's planning on doing the fall semester of her senior year on the island. After that, she wants to transfer to a college on the mainland. Leonardo, though, is ready to settle back home, and he's switching his major from anthropology to education.
Especially now that in Puerto Rico, many things are going on with the education department and with public schools. And this opportunity, since I'm here, I have been thinking that not many students in Puerto Rico will have this opportunity. And if I can maybe be a teacher and I can give to them what I've learned from all these experiences, well, that's what I would like.
But it will still be hard to leave Maine.
My brother mentioned that this is like the ideal vacation for me because I really like studying. And since here I've got everything, you know, they hand you everything sort of in golden trays, you know, like all your food. So I want to go back home, but I know that when I go back home, I'm going to miss this. So it's kind of that weird feeling. I don't even know if there's a word to describe it.
For The World, Lisa Bartfight, Brunswick, Maine.
Another big transition ahead for Veronica and Leonardo and many other Puerto Rican students like them. Here's hoping for an easy transition. And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.